From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times, and I'm your moderator, Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington, D.C. Welcome, everyone, to Issues in the News, brought to you from remote locations as we practice safe social distancing during these extraordinary times. For this week, here are the issues. The coronavirus pandemic continued to wreak havoc on nations around the world as the numbers of cases diagnosed and fatalities continued to rise. In the United States, New York State rapidly became the epicenter of the pandemic, with about 6% of the world's confirmed cases diagnosed there, with more than half of those in New York City. Global markets plummeted as investors reacted to business across the globe coming to a virtual standstill. However, there was a glimmer of hope as the United States Senate approved a $2 trillion package aimed at providing relief to ailing businesses and individuals. The bill now goes to the House of Representatives, where a vote is expected within a few days. And concerned over the prospect of a lasting recession, U.S. President Donald Trump signaled impatience with the stay-at-home orders recommended by health experts. Stating that the cure can't be worse than the problem, President Trump expressed his desire to at least partially stand down from social distancing and other public health measures as soon as April 12th. Panelists, thank you so much for joining again in these exceptional, special circumstances. We're all recording from our home studios, and thank you so much for it. Just want to start off with a couple of statistics from the World Health Organization. We have, as of this recording, 414,000 confirmed cases, 40,000 over the last 24 hours, 18,440 deaths, 2,200 over the last 24 hours. The rate of infection and death seem to be ramping up, especially in the United States, as testing finally comes online. I'll start with you, Josh. It seems as though the U.S. is finally getting a feel for exactly how serious this is, how pervasive a problem it is. Is it just a testing? Has it always been like that? Or is there an opportunity for the U.S. to have, I'd say, a chance for the U.S. to be in the same situation as Italy with the rampant spread of the virus there?
Yeah, I'm afraid to say, Michael, I think there's more than a chance. I think it's looking more likely than not at this stage. You're right to point out that a lot of the big jumps in numbers we're seeing in America are from increases in testing. So it's hard to know what the true numbers are or anything like what the true numbers are at this point, because the testing regime is still massively catching up to the spread of the virus. But the numbers we're seeing out of New York are very severe. You know, there's been a pretty much 100% increase since Sunday in New York. And what we've seen happen in Italy, in Spain, in Iran and elsewhere is that when the numbers rise, there's a lag, but then the deaths start to rise too as hospitals become overwhelmed. We've read the first reports today and yesterday of hospitals in New York overwhelmed of people dying in waiting rooms or seriously ill in waiting rooms, with doctors unable to treat them without the capacity to treat them. So I'm afraid to say there seems like a very significant chance that we are going to see a big, big spike in deaths over the next 3 weeks in America.
And I'll stay with you for a second to ask about Prime Minister Boris Johnson imposing strict rules after a long delay where there really weren't very many restrictions in place. Another case of too little, too late there?
History will judge Boris Johnson. I think his instincts and his political instincts were that he didn't want to shut down the economy, much as Trump doesn't. Both have a sort of libertarian streak in them, if you like. But there is an ongoing debate in Britain's scientific community that has implications for the whole world, really. Scientists from Imperial College believe, have modelled this thing to be unbelievably fatal in both America and Britain. And a lot of the decisions being made about lockdown are based on the Imperial model that came out a couple of weeks ago. Scientists at Oxford, however, are saying that they think a lot more people have this virus than we think, and therefore many more of us are what they call asymptomatic than we think, and therefore actually we may reach what they call herd immunity sooner than expected, which would be great news. But, you know, these are models that are being done at rapid speeds on insufficient data, so we have to be a little bit humble about what those numbers mean. I'm afraid to say history will judge Boris Johnson. It's hard to say now, but Britain is now in full lockdown for 3 weeks. So, you know, hopefully that will flatten the curve and stop the spread of the virus.
Kimberly, as I mentioned in the open, in New York State, they are facing desperate conditions with only a fraction, apparently, of the medical supplies that are needed. Things like masks, ventilators, even certain therapeutic drugs are in very, very short supply. The federal government is putting a lot of the responsibility for obtaining necessary supplies on the state governments, on the governors themselves. Is this being perceived as a good idea, as a good way of governing and managing the situation?
Well, it depends on who you ask, really. I mean, this is on full display every single day. The governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, gives a press conference basically laying out just how dire their situation is, the needs they have, the deaths, the shortages, and begging effectively the federal government to step in and to organize a unified response across the nation, followed a few hours after by the daily White House press briefing from the Coronavirus Task Force, in which the president continues to say that the states should buy their own ventilators and get their own supplies, and that the federal government is providing some, but the main purchaser and main organizer of these things needs to be the individual states. Now, the argument there is that each state has a different situation, and so there should not be a one-size-fits-all solution coming down from the federal government. But as, you know, states like New York and California are complaining, what's happening in the market for these medical supplies is that states end up competing against other states, against other countries, against hospitals for the same limited pool of supplies, which is driving up the price of these very crucial supplies and ventilators and masks. We even had a letter this morning from the medical devices industry asking the federal government to step in to regulate the distribution of these items, because the medical device industry, the people who are making these ventilators, are in the unenviable position of having to decide which hospitals get ventilators, which states get ventilators, and they don't want to be put in that position.
And then I think Andrew Cuomo, as you'd mentioned in one of his press conferences, said, made a very dramatic statement about not having enough ventilators, and asked the federal government, you come and tell us which 26,000 people should die because they don't have the proper equipment for the situation. And Kimberly, the last time we were together on the show, you made a very insightful comment about how it seemed that there were people of privilege who were able to get tests, that we knew about people like Tom Hanks and certain athletes. And now we've seen that Prince Charles has been tested positive. How people of means seem to be able to get tests while other people seem not to be able to. Has there been any closing of the gap in the ability for people to want a test and need a test to actually get a test?
Well, I should probably, you know, highlight here that when we're talking about Prince Charles, who's in the UK, versus the athletes here in the US, versus Tom Hanks, who, if I'm not mistaken, was in Australia when he was diagnosed, every different country has a different testing regime with different priorities. Here in the US, we have just had a shortage of tests. Now, the production of these tests and the distribution of these tests has ramped up significantly since you and I last spoke. However, we are still not to the place here in the United States where every single person who wants a test can get one. We're running out of some of the supplies that go into those tests. And what the federal government, or at least the medical experts at the federal level, are saying at this point is, if you're not showing symptoms, please don't go to get tested. And even if you are showing symptoms, they are prioritizing medical personnel, sort of these frontline workers who have to put themselves at risk to try to save people right now, and then more at-risk people, the people in these older age groups. Now, of course, now we're hearing about more and more severe cases in younger people, but still the information that we have is that older people are at the highest risk of death. So medical experts at the top federal levels are asking people to allow them to prioritize sort of these first responders in the testing.
Josh, I'll go to you to weigh in on the government solution, because it seems that as though this is a problem that is uniquely requires a good government for the populace to be able to come through it. Now, I'll talk about the United States, the federal government more or less backing off, and you have the president saying things like, we're not a shipping clerk, and pitting the states against each other to bid for things like ventilators and masks and that sort of thing. Your thoughts about the role of the federal versus the state governments in alleviating these problems?
Just one thing I'd like to quickly add on the testing is that we are very close to having antibody tests widely available, which would be a huge bonus because that can test you to see if you've had the virus at any point and develop the antibodies. And if you have, well, then you may be able to re-enter the economy because you've developed some level of immunity. So that's something to look out for. It's coming down the pipeline fast, and that may help us on the economic side of this. In terms of the government response, unfortunately, you can't take the politics out of this, even in a crisis of this scale. You know, there's a lot of rhetoric from the president. He's looking to distance himself from the economic pain that Americans are already feeling and is only going to mount over the next month or two. He's making it look as though he's being dragged into this shutdown by scientists, by states, by Democrats, by the media, and so that when Americans feel the pain in their pocketbook and they start losing their jobs, well, they're not going to blame the president. That's his hope. You know, federal versus state is a perennial issue in American life. I think the federal government is doing a lot. I'm sure it could do more. But at the same time, there was a very good piece in the New York Times on Sunday by Anne-Marie Slaughter saying America will save itself, by which she means this is a country of enormous resource. There are excellent governors out there. There are excellent mayors out there. Private companies are stepping in all over the country, from Tesla to Google, and from to backwards distillers who are stopped making whiskey and started making hand sanitizer. You know, this is a country of enormous ingenuity and fortitude, and that's what the world admires about America. I think it will need to call on all of those resources and all of that ingenuity to push through this crisis.
I would only agree with that and everything that you said. Very insightful. We're going to take a quick break and we'll come back with more Issues in the News. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington, D.C. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castillo. Now back to our panel. Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times, and I'm your moderator, Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington, D.C. Panel, we started to touch on President Trump, and I'm going to move to his news conferences. And as you've both mentioned, President Trump is giving daily news conferences in the White House, and I think it's actually great to see the White House press room being used again on a regular basis. Sadly, it's for this, but it's a useful tool that the White House is taking advantage of. The combination of information and catharsis that we see over the podium is really quite interesting to me. As the president declares himself a wartime president for the nation, but also uses the platform to attack his perceived political enemies and the invisible enemy, the virus that he talks about. Kimberly, I'll start with you. After a period of being very circumspect for President Trump and being very serious and taking up the call for social distancing and these things, is looking to lift the restrictions. Why does he feel this way so suddenly? Is there anything in particular that has pushed him over into that camp of let's look to lift these restrictions rather than let's continue with what we have to do to solve the health crisis?
Well, I won't pretend to know the intricacies of President Trump's mind in terms of his feelings behind things, but he is a president who has, throughout his administration, very much looked to the markets and the performance of the economy as a reflection on his performance as president. He likes to tout when the markets are up, when the jobs numbers are good, which they have been for much of his presidency, because we have been in sort of an economic expansion that started during the Obama administration, but has really reached new heights under the Trump administration. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act in 2017 that allowed corporate America to do particularly well and gave some tax cuts to other Americans also. And so now to see the markets just absolutely tanking and unemployment skyrocketing and the economy basically ground to a halt, there have been a lot of commentators and pundits here in Washington that say this is going to be very, very damaging for his reelection come November. You know, if you're a president who's running on the good economy and the economy is terrible through something that you had no control over effectively, that is the virus, but then you did have control to some extent over the reaction to it, there is a lot of belief that he's starting to get very concerned about what this means for his long-term political prospects.
Josh, Dr. Tony Fauci, one of the leading doctors and medical minds about this situation in the world, has been sort of front and center for quite some time in talking about what we really needed to do to solve the health crisis. And it seemed as though the medical community, the science community, had the ear of the president and was really guiding the message along. That relationship between the medical community in general and Dr. Fauci in particular seems to have eroded. Has that community lost the ear of the president, and is someone else more closely guiding him now, someone in some other community, be it economic, political, what have you?
Well, I think certainly Dr. Fauci, his role has diminished. People in Trump world, the president included, have taken askance at his conversations with the media, parts of the liberal media, where he's been quite openly critical of the president or showed his dissatisfaction with elements of what Trump does. And as we know, you just can't, in the court of King Trump, that just doesn't fly. So Fauci's on the outs. Dr. Deborah Birx, however, is still there and still playing a very pivotal role. But you're right. I think initially Trump wasn't listening to the science at all. He was going on TV saying, this will be down to zero cases soon. We've got a hold of it. There was a clear period where the science was getting through to him, Fauci and others, and he took it very seriously and he put the weight of the federal government behind it. And I think we're still in that phase, but he's clearly buckling. The economic numbers are scaring him. And as we know with Trump, he's volatile and he's mercurial and he will change his opinions according to his instincts and not necessarily according to the science. And so we are seeing a bit of a conflict between his instincts on the economy and what the science is telling us in terms of the spread of the virus. And that conflict is going to only continue over the coming weeks. And it could get quite confusing and messy for the American people.
Kimberly, the president says that the cure can't be worse than the problem. And this seems to be a line that was extracted from a conservative television host and has been echoed in his press conferences and town halls time and time again for the last few days. There are estimates of a potential for 30% unemployment if the economy were to be shut down for months, as recommended by health experts. The president says it's not a financial crisis, but a health crisis. But isn't he risking seeming more concerned about the markets than human life if he really does lift these restrictions before science says that it's a reasonable thing to do?
The president has, you know, given indication that he'd like to see people sort of returning to work, businesses reopening around Easter, because that is a date that he likes, which is not within the parameters that medical professionals are recommending at this point. And I mean, if you unpack the argument, this, even the statement, the cure can't be worse than the problem. Well, if your problem is tens of thousands, potentially hundreds of thousands, millions, if the worst estimates are accurate, if the problem is millions of people dying, and then your cure is economic collapse, I mean, you are kind of pitting one against the other. And I think what many of the cooler heads in the room are trying to say is that this is a false choice. We shouldn't be thinking about choosing the lives of people over the economy or vice versa. We need to come up with solutions that are going to protect public health while also preserving people's livelihoods and ability to at least get by until we get through the health crisis. And I think the markets have responded positively to the bipartisan Senate bill that was passed this week, because it looks like there is at least some effort finally happening in Washington to sort of find that calmer middle ground that recognizes the severity of the public health threat, but also the need to preserve the economy, because when people's economic lives are in crisis, their health is in crisis also. There's a lot of research to support this over the years.
And I want to get into it with you a little bit on the relief package. I know we just got that released just a couple of days ago, and there's, as you say, a lot to unpack. Could you give us a couple of the highlights that are in there? Who's getting relief? What guardrails there are to prevent corporate abuse? Are there corporate bailouts involved, if you use that term broadly? And will it in fact be enough?
Well, it's not going to be enough. And even the writers of this legislation admit it's not going to be enough, and that there's probably going to need to be more stimulus and additional legislation to cope with both the health and economic consequences of the pandemic. This includes direct cash payouts to many, many Americans. Most Americans, I believe, will end up getting a check of something like $1,200. And that's just cash to sort of keep you going. If you're filing for unemployment, which goes through the states here in the U.S., the individual states, they're giving extra money to the states to help bolster those unemployment insurance payments, and also giving people a little bit of extra cash there to try to carry them through. For businesses that keep their staff on their payroll, payroll, even if they're losing money. The small businesses can get loans to cover that, that can then sort of basically forgiven through a particular maneuver. Afterwards, if you just keep your staff on your payroll, there's more money for the hospitals and gosh, there's so many things in this. In terms of oversight, this was a big fight and that held it up for a couple of days in terms of the money going to these sort of bigger industries like the airlines and to the bigger corporations, how much oversight there would be. And the Democrats and the Republicans hammered out a deal where there will be some oversight. There's a congressional panel that's going to have a look at this in addition to people in the administration who'll be keeping an eye on it.
Josh, your thoughts on the relief package. Any thoughts on what's in it and what isn't in it?
It shows you that Congress can actually pass legislation when it needs to, which is quite a relief. No, it's an impressive package. They've come up with it fast and it's big. As Kimberly says, nothing really that they could do could fully cover the scale of the crisis that's approaching, but it's big and it's impressive. And I think the particular, you know, it seems to balance the Republican priorities with the Democrat ones in terms of $500 billion in corporate aid, but also significant assistance to those on unemployment benefits. So, you know, it seems to have a good balance of priorities, and I think will probably help to stem the bleeding that the American economy is going to face over the next couple of months. So, I mean, for once, we can pat Congress gently on the back, I think.
Very gently for now. Yeah. Kimberly, I want to go to you because I know that it's in general unseemly to talk about the politics of this. We are in the middle of a health crisis, but the politics are here right in front of us. And we do have to face that. And I want to ask you, as you look forward into your crystal ball, coming out on the other side of this as we emerge from this, as we eventually will, do you think that this will shape up to be, even after all of the bluster, all of the controversy of the Trump presidency, is this likely to be the defining issue, not only for him, but for basically every candidate on the ballot in November?
I think it depends on how many people die. I think that's what it's really going to come down to. Depending on how long the outbreak really shuts down the economy, and that could last anywhere from a couple of months to some estimates are saying waves of this for as long as 18 months. If we do a good job at social distancing and washing our hands and flattening the curve, as everyone says, perhaps we won't have the numbers of people dying that we see. But if a lot of people end up dying as a result of the way the American government chose to respond to this crisis, it is going to be very challenging for the president to run on his record, if his record is that. Now, that said, President Trump has quite an astonishing record of being able to detach himself from bad things that happen under his watch. And so it will be very fascinating to see how he talks about that and how the Democrats talk about it, how his eventual competitor, which we now strongly believe to be Joe Biden, as Josh and I were discussing the last time that we were here, despite the fact that Bernie Sanders is still in the race. This will be the defining issue of the election. The question is, will Trump allow it to be the defining issue of his presidency?
Josh, your thoughts on that subject?
It's hard to believe that a tanking economy, and as Kimberly says, if we do see really bad death numbers, it's hard to believe that that won't in some way damage the president. But such is the nature of polarization in this country. He will be able to hold on to his base, you would expect, and to persuade them that none of this is down to him, and he will find enemies to blame. And we're kind of already seeing the contours of that. But yeah, my expectation is, again, peering into the future, that this probably will damage him because, frankly, he hasn't done a great job. And if numbers do start to rise and the cost does start to rise, it's hard to believe that people are going to credit him with that. And it's not all his fault. Of course it's not, but, you know, an economic disaster, a personal disaster, a health disaster, none of this can reflect well on him ultimately.
And to be completely dark about it, it may not just come down to who lives and dies, but as we face the polarized map, political map in the States, it may come down to where that all happens as well. Yes. In which states that happens. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this week. Many thanks to our panel. Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times. I'm your moderator, Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington, D.C. This program is produced by VOA's Kim Lewis. And I, again, am Michael Williams. Be safe, everyone, and thanks for listening.